I'm not too much of a riddle you with quotes kind of a preacher. I want to begin with a quote, though, from a really smart Christian theologian, thinker, a man by the name of A.W. Tozer, who once wrote this: Christianity at any given time is strong or weak depending upon her concept of God. I'll back that truck up for a second. Christianity at any given time, we could say out of that, the church at any given time is strong or weak depending on her concept and her view of God. Basically, how we think about God determines the strength of our spine, our backbone as a church. It forms us. It's that important. And if that's true, and I think that it is, then it's hugely important for us to think about this question. When we think about God, and especially when we think about who God is, what he's like, his might and strength and his power, his ability, when we think about God, what comes to mind for us? Or another way to put it, when we think about God, how big of a view of God is that? How big is our God when we think about God? Because the basic problem could really be for the church, for even perhaps me as a follower of Christ, the basic problem could really be that we have a hard time clearly and accurately and biblically thinking about God, about who he is, what he's done, what he wants to do, how big our God is. But what we often do is we tend to impose our own framework, our own sort of size. We impose that, or at least we try to impose that upon God. Kind of like the idea of God in a box and what size that is. Now, I've had a couple of people already try to throw out my box. I brought someone who was tidying up the stage here earlier, you know, like, oh, we'll put this in. No, that's my prop. That's my prop. It's my box. Now, yes, it's a wine box. I'm aware that it's a wine box. I don't really hang around and drink wine by the box at the house necessarily, in case that's your thought. But I brought along a moving box. This has been a moving box that I don't know how many times this has been used, but we're pretty good at kind of sifting through all of the leftover moving boxes from different moves. But I was reflecting upon this, and it was sort of sobering and sad, sobering with the red wine box in mind, pun intended. It was kind of sad all at once that if you include a six-week stint of living in a camper, which is part of our legacy, I have lived since my childhood 23 different addresses. So that kind of sounds ridiculous, especially given the fact that really I grew up in a little tiny community pretty much in the same house. My dad built another house, but pretty much in the same house across the street. Grew up my first 18, 19 years, so I suppose, you know, you throw in college and then a few more years of seminary, and then you throw in, you know, build some houses and move around. 23 different places that I've lived, so I've become very acquainted with boxes. Now, as a total aside, everybody knows who's moved 23 times, that the best boxes you get are from the liquor store. They really are. Everybody's nodding to say they really are. They're the strong ones. You know, they're just the right size as we go. But we've had, my wife and I have had this kind of ongoing banter about boxes, and she's a get-it-done kind of gal. She makes moving very easy because she'll just, you know, on the tear. But this has happened more than once where the box size is really important. So here's what I mean. I have gone along before and found a box, you know, the toilet paper towel boxes that are big enough to put your fridge in, like those ones. I've gone along and, you know, oh, good, there's the last box. And, yeah, I just threw some things in that box in the garage. So, you know, you bend at the legs and, you know, keep your back straight. Go to lift this thing up and, oh, it's got books and kitchen appliances in it. And you're like, but it's the size of a crate. Like, there's no way that we're... So I prefer the small to medium-sized box that no matter, like, this could have my coin collection in it, and I still might be able to actually move this box. Well, all right, the box is just simply a physical touch point for the idea this morning, kind of the launch pad and really the landing spot of how do we think about God and this whole notion of God in the box. How big is that box that you conceptualize? Now, I understand this is metaphor. God does not reside in boxes as if we could put him in one. But how big is the box sometimes that we think about when we think that God is in? How often do we do that with God, where we somehow, not that my thoughts would ever limit God's power, But to say, wow, my view of God is like a small-sized box, or it's a medium-sized box, or maybe it's a larger-sized box, whatever it is. And this seems to be one of the things that we're encountering throughout the previous 10 chapters and weeks in the story, challenged with this idea of just how big is God? What can God actually do? Will God really come through in this way, or in this chapter of the Israelite story, or in this person's life, or whatever, that no matter how big the box is that we have for God, it's still too small. It's still too small. And of course, the whole discourse around boxes and God, yes, is quite silly, just a visual for us. Any box that we could ever imagine, of course, is far too small for our God. But how might things change in our lives if our idea and our concept of God even grew substantially? Would that make any difference in our lives? Because sometimes, I think often, I know I'm guilty of this in my own life, we put God in a sized box that is relative to our faith. Sometimes we put God in a box that is kind of in direct proportion to the amount of our lives that we want to hand over, right? Like to say, we might not articulate it out loud, but to have this wee little box and say, okay, God, here's the box that you can, you know, fit in, representative of, here's really how much of my life that I really want you to have. Sometimes that box size has to do with just our own kind of view of the depth of our own faith. Other times we put God in the box that's relative to our feeling of even shame and distance from God. Here's what I mean. Well, I just don't really have a faith that's that strong. God could never use me. God's just probably given up on me. I'm too far gone. I'm past that point of no return. There's just too much water under the bridge. I'm no good. I'm damaged goods. I shouldn't even be here on a Sunday. You know, the lightning bolts might strike the roof. That's a regular comment I get, by the way, right? Pretty revealing of our lives. And I believe that what God can do in our lives comes in direct proportion to our ability. We need to grab onto this, I think. What God can do in our lives comes in direct proportion to our ability to repent and turn back to Him and really seek Him. I think that's the kind of followers that God is especially excited about. Well, last week through the story, we considered the tragic example of Israel's very first king, and that was Saul, the one who looked like he had everything going for him, all the makings of being a great leader and a great king for God, but it ended up becoming a disaster. If you're in my Thursday small group, you'll know this, because he was impatient, impetuous, prideful, insecure. We had great list of descriptors for Saul. But never mind any of that, because Saul's biggest problem, perhaps, his biggest issue was one of faith and functionally how big a view of God he really had. It was a problem of faith, believing that God was actually big enough, good enough, strong enough to accomplish what he says that he's going to accomplish. So here's what's been going on in the story. If you've been reading along, this will be familiar to you. If you haven't, then this is a real quick catch-up. We're at the point where Israel as a nation, as a people, they've rejected God as kind of their leader in this theocracy with God at the head. And instead, they reject that kind of leadership and they say, no, we want a king like every other nation around us. They insist. And in really a terrifying kind of way, I really do think that God gives us what we really want. I think God always and ultimately gives us what we really want. What I mean is it if I want a life that is surrendered and sold out in pursuit of Him, and I want more and more of Him in my life, and I orient my life that way, He will grant that. If I want no thanks, I'm doing my own thing and I'm going my own way, I think ultimately God will grant that. And so this all transpires. And God says to Samuel, Samuel, the people want a king, and just know that they're not rejecting you, they're actually rejecting me. Give them a king. And from there on, God's people were literally on a different trajectory in their history. And just as God warned through Samuel, it's going to be a train wreck with a king, and it was. The cracks were already clearly forming in Saul's life, and we see those cracks form not if, but when is this thing going to come completely undone? And here in chapter 11, God tells Samuel to go to Jesse's house at Bethlehem. God actually has in mind there's a different king who's coming down the pike because Samuel is kind of crumbling as, or Saul rather, is crumbling as we watch it unfold before our eyes. So Samuel, under the Lord's direction, heads to Bethlehem, to Jesse's house, in search, presumably, of a new king. And he arrives there, and he sees Jesse's sons, and kind of makes his way through them, and he sees his sons. He sees the oldest. Eliab is the one, the tall one, the obvious one, the mature one. So here it is. Here's the new king, obviously. So here's the high priest. Here's Samuel, kind of with a small-sized God box to say, well, obviously, we're going to use the big, strong, mature, oldest guy once again, as though he's got it figured out. But not so. God has something different in store. God has a different choice to make. 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 7, we read this. But the Lord said to Samuel, as he's kind of sizing up the new kings, don't judge by his appearance or height. For this one, the one you're looking at, I've rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And when our faith is small about how God can work, when the box that we think we will put God in is small somehow, it has all kinds of implications for our lives. It affects us, I think, in all kinds of ways that we're often not typically aware of. And really, out of that, a few ideas I want to share with you in our time remaining for this morning. When we put God in the box, whatever size that is, when we put God in the box, firstly, we put a limit on whom God can use. Now, I'm not able to limit God in what he wants to do with anything, but it's though our scope, our perspective of what God might do shrinks. We put a limit on whom God can use, who we think is up to the task, who we think God is interested in. We see Samuel discerning the choice for the next king of Israel, and he's at Jesse's house, and he basically runs out of sons on the list to kind of be like, him? Mm-mm. Him? Nope. Him? Nope. Him? Nope. And Samuel was stumped to be like, okay, God directed me here. God has a new king in mind. Kind of, is there anybody else? Do you have another son that's kind of hidden away somewhere? To which Jesse says, yeah, actually, I do. I do. I have another son. And of course, Samuel is connected with David, and it all unfolds from there. David's kind of, it would seem from a human perspective, David's the leftover choice. You know, like the YMCA kid, you know, you're picking teams and there's the one kid left. Oh, you can have him, you know. Like, that's David at the end. Like, well, there's one guy left. He's the youngest and he's small. And, you know, he's really not that developed yet in all these ways that his brothers are and their abilities and their leadership. But God sees things differently. God sees the heart. God has a perspective that allows him to see who we are, not just what we look like or what people think we have to offer. David had a heart after God's, the scriptures tell us. David had a heart, and I think this is at play. I think David had a heart that was after God even before he was at all aware that he had a heart that was after God's. I think God was forming that in him. The point being, stick close to God because there's no telling what God might do with us. But David is described as ruddy. That's an adjective that we just don't use anymore. Ruddy, rugged, handsome, maybe even charismatic, charming, all of these attributes. Samuel encounters David, and he knows in an instant, he knows that he knows under God's leading and direction that this is the one. Samuel pours the oil over David to anoint him, which for us culturally is a weird way to kind of, you know, we like to cut a ribbon or eat a piece of cake or something. This was anointing with oil in this culture and context as a sign that he was the Lord's chosen. But we can get this idea even with David's background. He's described as handsome. He's described as, you know, kind of talented in his own way. We can get this idea in our own estimation that if you want to be successful or even used by God, that you should endeavor, you know, God uses the good-looking ones, the ruddy, handsome ones, Where, not at all. I remember in preaching class, I remember having a lot of conversation about decorum and down a few rabbit trails in terms of dress and appearance. And we got down some really weird rabbit trails, and I remember one comment being made to say, if you think the Lord is going to use you at all in your preaching, then you better at least look the part. Which, that's a dangerous spot to get to in a hurry and a very slippery slope. Like, I don't want to come in on a Sunday morning and look like I just got in from cleaning the attic either, necessarily. But God looks at something far more deeply. He doesn't just use the ones that we deem the handsome ones, the talented ones, the ones with all the potential. Not at all, because that makes it about us when it's all about God. Theologian Carl Henry was once asked where the next generation of Christian leaders would come from, to which his response went something like this: I don't know, they're probably all still pagans. And I love that comment to say, you know what, maybe the next great leader that God has in mind for the 21st century or down a couple of generations down the road for the 22nd century or whatever is, in our estimation, the worst of sinners, the most immoral person, whatever, that God has plans to redeem and restore their lives, that if we kind of ranked them in a checklist, they're not the people that we would ever choose, but they're exactly the people that God is pursuing. We ought to pay attention to that. No one believed that David would be God's choice according to the external metrics of it all. And when we put God in a box, we put a limit on whom God can use, or at least who we think God can use. Second, when we put God in a box, a view that's too small of God, I have this conversation often, we can feel like nothing is happening in our lives, only to find out later that actually lots was happening. What I mean is those times and seasons and periods where you think, you know what, there's been no like spiritual fireworks in my life. I don't feel like there's been, you know, these big brick walls that have been torn down in my life or any dramatic type things that are going on. You know, I'm just kind of trying to obediently follow the Lord and kind of walk in his ways and stay close to him, but I don't feel like, you know, there's like streamers being shot around or any such thing. We can feel like nothing is happening only later to find out that nothing meant everything, that there's actually lots going on as we simply and obediently follow the Lord. Consider this. I've often sort of run this scenario through my head. Most people, most Bible scholars feel like David is approximately 14 years old, give or take, when he has this encounter with Samuel, when he's anointed with oil, basically selected as the new king. He's around 14 years old. I've got a son who's almost 14 years old, so that's easy for me to conceptualize and kind of incredible for me to conceptualize at once to say, wow, you know, hey, Dad, someone came to the house and they rung on the bell and they dumped oil on my head and they left, to be like, wow, you know, that's biblical, son. It's hard for me to imagine what that is like. But the thing I find interesting is what happened to David after he was anointed, right? Because Saul's still king. It's not like they had this inauguration parade and party for David and Saul left town. No, what happens to David? He goes back to what he was doing. He goes back to being the shepherd boy. He goes back to the fields, back to his ordinary kind of predictable life that was going on before. That is seriously anticlimactic, isn't it? And David doesn't even ascend the throne right away at all. It's interesting to think about what that must have been like. It's kind of like, you know, in south of the border, because it's so dramatic and spectacular, when the election happens in November and then the president-elect is determined, there's this period of time, right, from November to January to when kind of swearing-in inauguration happens. You've got this period of time where, yeah, you're the incoming POTUS, you know, the president of the United States, but you're not acting as the president quite yet. There's the in-between. This is very much what's taking place in David's life. But imagine that took place and you're kind of voted in, you're the president-elect, and then you go back to like Burger King the next day and you're flipping burgers and you're back in class and you're resuming the life of a 14, 15-year-old. Well, sometime later, the present king, Saul, decided that a songwriter, poet, musician guy was going to be a help to the court, so David is brought in on that. David was used by the king in that capacity according to how God had gifted him, not in fireworks, spectacular kind of ways, at least at this point in time. More time passes, maybe a couple of years' time, but by the time we get to the story of Goliath. Now, if I spout out David and Goliath, most people that don't even have much of a strong Bible background, they know what I'm talking about. But David is perhaps 18, 19 years old when that story unfolds, is a good guess. Supposedly, if you were 20, you were a conscript into the army, and he was too young for the army. So time had gone by, maybe 18, 19 years old. So here's David, 5 years, 5+ years, one writer says, singing songs and slinging rocks. That kind of sums up his life for that time in the in-between. And of course, David's dad sends him out into the fields, out into the sort of the battlefield to check on the soldiers, among which who are his brothers. And we see the standoff, and I mean, I could talk for a long time, but I won't, about that whole standoff between the Philistines and the Israelites. And instead of everybody fighting and mass bloodshed and casualty, it was choose one on one and we'll have them fight, and the winner will be the winner for their army. And this is going on for days and weeks, this Goliath giant and mocking Israel, mocking their supposed God who is all-powerful, and he stands before them day after day, and David makes his way in, and he encounters Goliath, and David is aghast to say, why isn't anybody doing anything? Why is this Philistine giant mocking God? Why is he mocking God's name and our nation and our soldiers? And David thrusts himself into battle against Goliath, and Saul says, okay, we'll gear you up, but the gear doesn't fit. It's too big. He's not accustomed to it. He's accustomed to songs and rocks. That's what he knows. So he heads into battle against Goliath, and of course we know how it goes. With nothing but a song and 5 smooth stones and a sling, nobody expected anything to happen, of course. This was the moment when here's the ruddy, handsome poet shepherd guy who's going to get run through, and the ruddy is going to be gone, and it's going to be replaced by ripped to pieces by Goliath. And of course, God grants David the victory, and God is actually at work behind the scenes the whole time, even 5+ years, singing songs and slinging rocks, when seemingly nothing was going on. He'd been anointed. Well, then what? I don't know. Go back to what I've called you to, back to the fields, back of tending sheep. And I love what we read that David proclaims. David replies to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you've defied. Today the Lord will conquer you. I love, this is not, I'm gonna whip you up with my sling. This was, today the Lord will conquer you. I will kill you and I will cut off your head. This is not ambiguous. I'm gonna tell you what's gonna happen, and then I will give the dead bodies of your men to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And everyone assembled here will know that the Lord rescues his people, but not with sword and spear. This is the Lord's battle, and he will give you to us. Kind of, any questions? Here's the 19-year-old non-soldier, too young to serve in the army guy coming in from tending sheep. David does not say, Israel will know that I'm the real king. He might have said that. He knew it to be true. Doesn't say any of that. The story really isn't David and Goliath. It's actually about God and Goliath. It's God's victory and God's battle, and of course we know what happens. Goliath is struck dead, and what David proclaims does come to pass. Remember that Goliath is there for days and days and days hurling his insults toward David's God and toward the Israel army for all that they represented. We can feel like nothing is happening, only later to find out that nothing meant everything. The last idea I want to share with you is really this. When you put God in a box, when we think too small about God, we waste too much of our lives staring at the giant or staring at our giants, whatever they might be. We waste too much of our life staring at the giant. Back in October, we were away on vacation, and one day we went to an indoor water park. It's the best indoor water park, maybe the best water park I've ever seen. Just incredible. And kind of the crowning jewel of this water park are these two drop slides. And what that means, if you don't know, basically you're in a tube, and you're standing on this what seems to be floor, but then at a certain time when they push the button, the floor just drops out from under you, and you just drop down in the tube and hope that there's a bend at the bottom, you know, that you don't just keep descending. And apparently it's fun. So it's supposed to be fun. So I made my way up to the, I kind of thought as we went that day, I'm going on the drop slide. I'm doing it. Yeah, I'm a little timid of water and speed and heights, but I'm doing it. I'm going on the slide. So I make my way up. It's a lot of stairs. I think it was 108 stairs or 110 stairs. All the way up to the top, and I'm kind of checking it all out. I'm being cool, right? And the bad thing is there was no line, so I couldn't even hide in people. So I'm just, you know, kind of like leaning on something like, hey, yeah, I'm just hanging out. It's fine, yeah. You want to go? Oh, no, I'm good. I just wanted some exercise up the stairs. And then before long, my oldest boy joins me, and he does the same. Like, yeah, it's cool, Dad. We'll just hang out here and kind of like taking a look all around. And we talk back and forth about the speed and the height and whatever. Like, you going to do it? I don't know. You doing it? I don't know. Maybe. And so we go back and forth on that. Finally, we're like, yeah, we're just going back down. So anyway, we go back down. Pretty much on the way down, meet my wife going up the stairs. So she goes up, and we're like, really? So we turn around, kind of go back up, and she kind of checks things out, and anyway, kind of goes and gets in. It looks like a coffin, actually. You get in, and then there's like a lid that closes over the top, so you can't escape at that point in time. You got this, like, got this thing over you, and then you just wait, because you know the floor drops out. So anyway, she goes, and it's like the funnest thing ever, and you know, on and on, we hear about it, and just the rush that it was. And despite all that, me and my son talking back and forth through the day, we going to go up and do the slide? Like, I don't know, maybe after lunch. And then so we have lunch, and the whole thing kind of unravels. And, of course, we don't. And we do the walk of shame back down the stairs. I'm still regretting not doing the tube. My son and I spent way too much time staring at it instead of just getting on with it, right? And I don't want to be cliche, because I've seen some awful like memes and bumper stickers about, you know, what's the giant in your life? And too much maybe gets made of some of that, but I think it's legit at some level. I don't want to be too cliched, but to say what's the giant, or never mind that phraseology, what's the thing you're staring at right now that you're like, ah, I know I really should do this. I know I really should deal with this. I really should go through this door that's opened. I really should have that conversation. I really should take this leap. And even all the while to say, I think God's even leading me to it, and we spend way too much time staring at it, fearful and reluctant. David, and I want you to not make a superhero out of David, because David, we're going to get to it in January. David is horrendously flawed. If you know the story of his life, you know that's true. We're going to get to that more in January as we pick things up with chapter 12. Don't make a superhero out of David. Don't make like some canonized saint out of David, because that's not who he is. But I love that David is the one who will chase after God's heart and what God desires, and David takes a run at it. He could have frozen in fear like the rest of the Israelite army. He goes for it in person, in the flesh, and we have no idea what's going on through David's mind as he does, but if David's pattern holds true, I wonder if he's recalling all of those situations where nothing was going on, it seemed, but he was in the fields, and he was defending a flock against the lion and the bear and every kind of threat and thing. And in an instant, it's, wow, God's really been preparing me for this right now. And here it is. David, in the situations that he faced at this point in his life, was unshakable in his belief that God was greater than... God was greater than this. God was greater than Goliath. This victory that God was going to hand over this battle was not going to be mine to fight, it's going to be God's. Because the backdrop of all that's going on that we find in the story through this part and through the preceding 10 chapters is all on the foundation of God's grace, what God is doing. It's not that Israelites are special because they're not. It's because God is special. It's because God is sovereign. It's because God is all-powerful and almighty. This is not a be like David sermon. This is a we have a great big God sermon. And this is, look how David was able to step out in faith in the midst of his flaws and his weakness. But with all things, big, small, everywhere in between, God cares, he's active, he's present, and he's good. That'll be a story for another day that I'll save. Long of it short, it's been a fun week preparing, and we've had some hurdles even preparing for Nativity, and so I'm excited that it's finally coming together. But even in the small things where I want to fix it and kind of patch it up kind of guy, even in just little instances this past week where it's like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how we're going to get this. I'm not sure how this is going to come together. And to say, God, pausing, which I don't normally do, I just want to charge in and do it, but to say, God, I need your help here. I need you to do this. And God shows up. David's running toward this giant, and he's preparing, as he's preparing to do that, giving all the credit to God, his goodness and grace, so that they will know, that everyone will know, there is a God in Israel. Sometimes the box that we carry around is just way too small. I know I'm so guilty of that in my own life, of believing what God might actually do and how capable and powerful he is. And we can get in the spot of what if and frozen in fear. What if Goliath wins? And what if I don't get the job? What if it doesn't work out how I planned? What if the test comes back positive? What if I don't ever meet someone? What if the economy doesn't turn around? What if my business fails? What if my kids who are on a slide, what if they don't come back around? What if this relationship isn't mended? And the what ifs end up dominating our lives instead of the God who's given them to us. So I love kind of landing in the spot of we really have a choice as we consider all of this, as we look to God. It's been written, it's been said, we have a choice where we can be a big person with a small God, or we can be a small person with a big God. I love what the New Testament scriptures say to us. John the Baptist talking about, I must decrease and he must increase. God gives us that opportunity. How big is the box? And then forget the box to say, how big of a view of our God do we really have? Would you pray with me? God, I thank you that there is nothing beyond you, that you've chosen in your sovereignty to give us the scriptures that tell us about who you are and what you are like, that nothing is too big for you. Not even sin and death, not any of the miracles that we see through the scriptures, not any of the what would otherwise be impossible spots. There's no giant that's large enough in the Philistine army. Nothing is too big for you. Nothing is impossible for you. You are that good, you are that big, and you are the one in whom we place our faith and our trust. I just pray really simply that I think every one of us here can identify with staring at the water slide, with staring at the giant, with kind of looking over the edge, or knowing that the door's been opened, or knowing that you're leading us to this, that, or the other thing, and really wondering if I'll have the strength to walk through, to take it on, to seize the opportunity, to have the conversation, to whatever. That's all of us. But courage in you does not mean we're not afraid. Courage and strength in you simply means that despite our fears, we will trust you and we will follow. Give us strength to do that. Give us the grace that's required to do that. We love you. We thank you. And we thank you for the amazing price that was paid for us, that you gave your son, that in his death we might find life. In Jesus' name we pray.